listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. Hosted by business and political expert Jay Amernick, political visionary and entrepreneur Rick Raddatz, and me, journalist in all media Heather Vail, The Political Fix reveals the answers we're all looking for. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern at politicalfixradio.com.
Welcome to The Political Fix. This is the show where we give you the best of the left and the right. We are now in the second week of October. It's October 8th today. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. Jay is a strategic planner who helps his clients create and implement plans, goals, tactics, and benchmarks. And he's also the bridge in Nevada for Israeli companies who want to expand their business into the U.S., which, yes, that does happen, Rick. And his development labs also create smartphone apps and inventions. Rick Raddatz is a serial entrepreneur and an internet marketer who has a degree in philosophy. That led to his political development that he calls the solution, and that solution is to cap and prioritize government spending. I'm Heather Vail, also known as The Unwrapper, a premier freelance interviewer and journalist in all media. Guys, welcome to the show. How's it going?
It is going well. You know, despite this being the fall of Jay, where everything seems to be trucking along nicely. It's, you know, and always with the change in the weather, it gets a little, it's a little unsettling at first, the change in the weather, I think.
Well, yeah. You know, I haven't actually been in Vegas for a few days. I've been in the Los Angeles area, so I'm not sure what the weather is over there. How's the weather holding up?
It's you know, it's dropped down to the 80s, but that's, you know, when it was, you know, 110.
Wow.
When it was 110, it is now 30 degrees cooler. That is substantially for us here, you know. So it's
it's been mid 90s here, so I just assumed it was the same over there, but hey.
It's maybe it is. I don't know. It feels whatever. I don't know. I'm not a meteorologist.
Yeah, of course. So how about you, Rick? How's it going in Colorado?
It's going great in Colorado. My wife has been gone for 2 weeks now on a trip to France with her mom. And so the house is a mess. And I've hired a household assistant in her absence. So the house is being picked up right now as we speak.
Okay. All right. Well, at least we know that you can take care of yourself while your wife is gone, you know.
Well, I'm really good at delegating and outsourcing, it turns out. Really good at that.
Excellent.
I think you always knew that. I mean, that's what you do in business as well, right?
So. Yeah. I've outsourced myself so much, I don't have a job anymore. So that's why I'm doing this.
You've outsourced yourself out of a job. Beautiful.
Yeah. All right, Rick, so before we get started with today's show, why don't you explain to everyone what exactly the solution is?
The solution. Okay, let's call it cap and prioritize. Cap and prioritize. Step one is to cap the heck out of government, just like the political right would love. And it turns out we can do that while maintaining the purchasing power of government, meaning we can let government spending grow a little bit every year to maintain purchasing power, and the economy still grows faster, so taxes will go down. So the right loves this cap. But then if we do one more thing, if we take the spending that's left and we prioritize it, for example, if we delegate the social spending to the states and have each state create their own way of prioritizing it, and they reprioritize it every year, over time we're going to find better and better ways to spend that constant purchasing power. And so that is the aggressive pursuit of social justice, helping the people who need help most, even though taxes are going down. So that's the aggressive pursuit of maximum freedom. We are uniting the values here, the left and right, under one solution, cap and prioritize. It helps us spend less than we would otherwise and spend better than we would otherwise.
Yeah, okay. Jay, do you have anything to add to that?
As always, no. It's working smarter, not harder. This is actually, and I don't know if I, the idea of giving it to the states is actually an interesting one. Wouldn't it be easier just to not, to, well, I guess you have to.
It's a good question, Jay. It's a good question. Let me answer it. Let's imagine we gave Congress the task of ranking all of the college football teams from top to bottom, okay? Now, they would never do this, but if we gave them that task and they actually did it, and they came out with their results, like, here's who we think is the best team in the country, there would be riots in the streets and people would die, okay?
Yes.
And here's the important thing. That is not a complaint or critique on Congress, okay? That's, if Congress could do that, the people would riot, meaning Congress is just the wrong level of government to make these kinds of broad prioritizing decisions. They may be the right people to take the money because they can, and we can't seem to stop them. But once the money is there, they have to then give it back to the states, let each state do their own prioritizing, and that's where we can start to see, the politics goes away, and we start fighting about what helps people best. And the proof that this can happen is that Oregon already is prioritizing their Medicaid spending, and has for 20 years. And it's hard, but governments don't do hard things unless it works. There has to be a political advantage to it. And so, it sticks around because once you start prioritizing, you can't stop. It would be greedy and foolish to stop. So it's almost impossible to start doing, but once you start doing it, it's almost impossible to stop doing. So we need a moment of clarity, and then we can implement cap and prioritize.
That kind of sounds like it's an addiction.
Yes.
Once you get started, you just can't stop, you know.
And you need more to get to your fix.
No, it is kind of a tipping point in a good way. Capitalism is another good example, or even democracy. It's hard to get these systems in place the first time, like trying to get Afghanistan to become a proper democracy and have a proper economy. That's hard, and we're probably going to fail. But, if you take a country like, what would be a good example, Singapore, okay? They had to have kind of a benevolent dictator come in almost a communist style, and just start saying, hey, we're going to be doing free market reforms, and here's how we're going to be doing them. And then they were able to kind of leap to this new economy that they have, and there's still a lot of room to go forward. But Singapore now is really doing good. And it's a lot about free market reforms, but it took a dictator to do it, essentially. There are these things that are hard to do the first time, and once you do them, the momentum builds in the positive way, and then they stick around.
Yeah. I think that's the same. Once people get a real taste of cap and prioritize, they will, not be able to get enough of it, because it'll just make sense, all around to both the left and to the right.
Yeah, okay. So last week, and this is not the top story, but last week we were talking about the Ebola virus and how there was one man in Texas who had it after traveling to Liberia. And there were a lot of questions up in the air. Nobody really knew what was going on. They said they were going to contain it and it wasn't going to spread any further. That original victim has died.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think about the whole Ebola thing?
Well, my initial, somewhat sense of panic, and again, I do like the CDC. I think they're a fine agency, but I think they were trying to their edict was, in this case, a little less about truth and more about not getting everybody hysterical. And I think they said things that they couldn't really back up. They said there's nothing to worry about, which is nonsense. Of course there's something to worry about. But they didn't want, panic in the streets. But it seems
right.
There's a little more to this. I don't think we're at panic in the streets yet, but I think there's something more to this. I think we need to know exactly what's going on. It was actually, I believe it was an Israeli news service that first reported that the patient had died. They were, and the Israelis are sending some medical teams to Western Africa, or Eastern Africa, excuse me.
Yeah.
Or Western Africa,
The officials are saying that there are 10 people that he was in direct contact with when he was contagious, and 7 of those people are health workers that had contact with him. And then there's another 38 people who may have come into contact with him. So it's close to 50 people who... may have been exposed to the virus.
And who had contact with other people.
Yeah, they're saying that they're going to continue their effort to contain it, but, you know, that's actually a lot of people to monitor.
It is, right, because then all those 50 people had contact with people. And they're saying, you know, initially they said it's very difficult to transfer. Now they're saying it's not so difficult to transfer. I mean, I think there's just a lot we don't know, and it's hard to know what the truth is. And I think we need to know the truth, tempered with, you know, what the CDC and other agencies are doing about it, without driving everybody, again, into a sense of a state of panic.
Well, the good news, I think, is that I'm guessing here, is that there probably isn't a single medical professional in the U.S. or Europe, I don't know about developing nations, that isn't aware of Ebola is happening now. And so I suspect that they're going to be more alert and more proactive and more responsive in the future as things come up. So I think that's kind of a natural adjustment that society makes without even trying that's going to help. Here, at least in the developed nations, one thing that scares me is that in Spain, one of the healthcare workers, a nurse, I believe, is confirmed to have it, or at least they suspect. And then a second one now, they're watching carefully. So she has a fever of some kind. So you know, the fact that so many healthcare workers, even or especially in Western Africa, are getting it too. I'm certainly they're trying to take precautions, but this thing does seem to be spreading more than they want, and it's kind of like a good viral example would be the music video Gangnam Style. Remember that video from a couple of years ago? You know,
yeah.
Imagine if the CDC's job was to stop the spread of Gangnam Style on YouTube, and how there's a point at which it starts spreading so fast, just because of the numbers, that you just can't catch up. And so while it's small, maybe the CDC can, with proper procedures, keep up. But if it breaks out of that, you know, limited capacity, we are toast.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is a far cry from the story last week where it was everything is beautiful. So...
They're not saying that they can't control. They're still saying they can control it. So their stance really hasn't changed. I mean, they acknowledged that this guy had it last week. They knew that there was the one case. So nothing has really changed as far as what the CDC and other health officials are saying.
Correct. All I'm saying is that the way this works mathematically is the Western world has a capacity to control it. And as long as the number of incoming patients is within that capacity, we're probably fine here in the U.S. But as it spreads like wildfire across West Africa, if we start seeing more and more inputs, more and more patients coming into the U.S. from somewhere with the problem, it can begin to overwhelm our capacity, and then we have a problem. So my big concern is what's happening in West Africa. Now, the good news is that on average, these outbreaks do reach a point, and then they stop. So, you know, it's very rare that one truly goes worldwide, like the bird flu is 1919, I believe. 20 million people died. So. You know, that can happen again, and it depends on if the virus mutates or not. I disagree with the CDC saying that we shouldn't restrict air traffic. That's silly. They say, oh, people have the right to return. Well, let's give them a date.
Yeah.
Come back in a week and stay in quarantine. And if you don't, if you choose not to, you lose your right of return because, you know, we got to take this seriously here. And then, you know, we don't have to cut out all air traffic. Leave the air traffic of people trying to go help, the Marines, the volunteers, medical professions, professionals, et cetera. You know, let those people go in. Don't guarantee a right of return without staying in quarantine. You know, modify the right to return to include quarantine. But you can stop, normal commercial traffic. the one argument against that is that if you kill the country's economy, you could cripple their infrastructure so much that then it does spread even more. Maybe that's an argument, but it's hard. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm not buying that argument.
Their economies are already crippled. I don't know how that.
Yeah, it's Liberia. They're bordering on in the toilet from years of Charles Taylor and all kinds of abuses at the top there. So I don't buy that.
Yeah.
So what's the top story, Heather?
Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back with the top story. So we'll be right back with you in a few minutes on the political.
It's a cliffhanger.
Welcome back to the Political Fix on this Wednesday, October the 8th. I'm Heather Vail, here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. Before the break, we were talking about the update on the Ebola virus outbreak. Last week, we had that as our top story, and everything was well and good, according to the CDC. Now that original patient has died, but they are still assuring us that it's not going to spread any further. So now we're going to go into the top story for the day. Are you guys ready for this?
Yes.
No.
All right.
It's coming anyway.
Okay, well, maybe we should wait a few minutes.
No? Still Rick's
okay, I'm ready now.
All
go
right.
ahead. Go ahead.
All right, this one comes out of Las Vegas. My hometown, Jay's hometown. I'm not there right now, but anyhow. So, a U.S. Supreme Court justice today temporarily blocked a lower court ruling that declared gay marriage legal in Idaho and Nevada, dashing plans in Las Vegas to start performing gay nuptials in the self-proclaimed marriage capital of the world. I don't think that's just self-proclaimed, by the way. I think it really is the marriage capital of the world. Nevada and Idaho had joined the growing number of states where same-sex marriage is legal when the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled yesterday that gay couples' equal protection rights were violated by the gay marriage bans in both states. In Las Vegas, the Marriage License Bureau had been expected to issue licenses for same-sex couples starting at 2 p.m. today. But Clark County Clerk Diane Alba told the Associated Press that it's clear, at least for now, that she can't issue gender-neutral marriage licenses after Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy's orders temporarily halting gay marriage. Kennedy's order came a little more than an hour after Idaho filed an emergency request for an immediate stay. The state's request said that without a stay, state and county officials would have been required to begin issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples this morning. The delay could last a few days. Kennedy's order requested a response from the plaintiffs involved in Idaho's gay marriage lawsuit by the end of tomorrow. Las Vegas had been preparing for gay weddings. The county's marriage licenses went gender neutral a couple of weeks ago just in case, and chapels had photographers practicing with models to see how they might best shoot two brides in gowns. In its decision yesterday about Nevada and Idaho's gay marriage bans, Ninth Circuit Judge Stephen Reinhardt wrote for a unanimous three-judge panel that laws treating people differently based on sexual orientation are unconstitutional unless there's a compelling government interest. He wrote that neither Idaho nor Nevada offered any legitimate reasons to discriminate against gay couples. And that decision came a day after the Supreme Court turned away state appeals, effectively legalizing same-sex marriage in several more states, bringing the U.S. total to 30. So, personally, I don't understand why they need this stay, but that's where we stand right now. We're kind of in a gridlock pattern. So
yeah.
What do you think, Jay?
So first, I like that the big concern in Nevada was the photographers, how two brides were going to look together in a gown.
You guys know, I also work as a wedding videographer. And, you know, and this was, several of the photographers were actually, this was a concern.
Okay. Well,
they've got their standard poses. They've got their standard poses. And now it's like, okay, now what do we do?
Well, let's hope that doesn't elevate to the Supreme Court level. I've said this specifically about gay marriage before. It's sort of a weird thing, and you know, you sort of hinted at it that it's a little complicated, and it's complicated because the fact that the government issues a marriage license to anybody is ridiculous. It's a violation, actually, of the First Amendment. Marriage is a religious term with religious origins and connotations. So it should not be, so the government should just issue simply a, you know, you, we recognize this union, if you want to call it a civil union, for everybody, for gay, straight, whatever, okay? And then leave it up to the individual church, synagogue, temple, what have you, and the individual clergy to say, yes, this is good with me, or no, this is not good with me. And leave it at that. And then if a gay couple is a member of a church and their priest or minister or whatever says, I'm not into this, then they can leave that and find one that's friendly to them. It's a religious question the government shouldn't be involved in. And here's what happens when there is a violation of church-state separation. All hell breaks loose. If they hadn't had the violation to begin with, this wouldn't be an issue. That we would have had gay marriage for years and years and years, because nobody is going to condemn a priest or a minister or a rabbi, an imam, what have you, to say, I wholeheartedly support this, and in my temple, synagogue, church, parish, what have you, we're doing this. Or to say, in ours, no, we don't. It's not in line with our religious beliefs, and nobody can force us to do it because that would be a violation of our First Amendment rights. And then you leave it at that. But there was that initial violation, and look how it's gone out of control.
Yeah.
So I okay. I personally support it. I think they should, you know, anyone should be able to marry whoever they want and be done with it.
Well, as always, I agree with half of what Jay said. I think there would be a lot of people who would complain about various ministers of various faiths doing different things if the government had never been involved. For example, if some rabbi decided that we can marry men to sheep, someone would complain, I'm pretty sure. If we could start to expand marriage to include certainly like multiple couples, okay? You know, polygamy, etc. People would complain. So, but I think Jay has a point there, where there is a need to clarify the kind of the private, you know, concept of marriage, what's going on between two individuals, and what is the government's role in noticing it. Even well, it turns out that a society benefits greatly from having stable married parents of kids. Because the number one source of poverty is single motherhood. That's where you're torn between, you know, hiring a nanny or a daycare service or something for your kids when you're at work, but then during those hours you're making as little as you're paying the nanny or the caregiver. So it like becomes this horrible series of challenges of how you afford all of these things. And some of us have the ability to make more money than others, and so we might have more choices. But if you look at the black community especially, that's the source of poverty, is all of these single mothers especially that have all these tough choices. And so the government does have an interest in promoting marriage stability, marriage in general, marriage stability. Now, whether or not that comes from whether or not that allows government to get into the whole same-sex marriage or not, that's yet another issue, okay? But it is an issue. I'm going to say that it's hard to stop freedom. Over time, over decades, over generations, people are going to keep on fighting for more and more freedom. There's no way to stop that. That's built into our human nature. And so gay marriage is inevitable. And anyone who believes it's wrong for X, Y, or Z reasons, okay, it's inevitable. It's going to happen. I think the writing is on the wall. I think the Supreme Court here is kind of waiting for a couple other cases to go through the federal level. Because so far, I believe all of the cases at the federal level have sided on the side of gay marriage, you know, pro-gay marriage. And so the Supreme Court is, I think, waiting for any case that comes on the other side so that they can have all of their kind of due diligence done for them in debating the core issues here.
Okay. My point is also that the government would still issue like a civil union certificate saying we as the government recognize this and all the rights and privileges that come with that, be they next of kin or whatever tax issues there are. I don't know all the benefits of being married now that the government allows, but I know that's some of them. So.
Well, most states, I think, do allow civil unions, even if the gay marriage is not legal.
But that falls under the category of a separate but not equal, because you're treating two citizens differently than two other citizens based on their preference. So that's what. Right. So on the government level, the government is neutral. Everyone gets a civil union. Done. Right. Whether it's up to the clergy whether it's recognized. In a religious fashion or not, and
that preference word is not kosher. Just so you know,
what
they don't consider it a preference. They don't consider it a preference.
Okay. That's the other. That's like the other challenge too. Is that it's not. It wouldn't fall under anything that's defined by in the Constitution. It's not. It's not a race. It's not a creed. It's not a. It's not a religion. I mean, it's.
It's a sexual orientation.
Okay, so then you have to add that into the language, the legal language, but it's not something as it sits now that would fall under that equal protection based on those three categories, based on race, religion, or creed. It's none of those.
Yeah. Okay.
So.
And you know what? Also, whoever wrote the Associated Press article. Focusing on two brides in gowns, that's very rarely going to happen.
Well, that's
more likely
that's
they're going to have two people in suits. They're going to have two people in suits, or regardless of the fact that there's two of the same gender, whether it's two males or two females, they're still going to have one in a dress, one in a suit. I mean, I've seen that already. The chances of there being two brides in gowns is very slim, in my opinion. I mean, maybe I'll get proven wrong, but I have yet to see that kind of dynamic. In a gay couple that, yeah, anyway.
But if they did, I fully support it.
So. You know, the concern with the photographers was more that they do specific photos.
Well, that's why I thought it was
like
so
the bride doing
that
a certain
that was...
thing and the groom doing a certain thing. So they were like, okay, well, what do we do with, you know, two people in suits? Was more of the concern. Like, okay, do we
two
still have one dip the other? The same, like the standard... groom dipping the bride shot, do we still do that when it's two men in suits? Like, that was more of the concern than two
why not?
Anyway. Yeah, why not? You do it both ways. Yeah, okay, you dip him, and then you dip him. That would work. You know, that's cool. Yeah.
It's a free country. What can I say?
Exactly.
and in many ways, getting freer all the time in terms of personal liberties. In terms of government control, it's kind of getting government's expanding more and more, so it's getting less free in those ways. But freedom, I think, has this pressure where freedom wins. And what we're fighting about now isn't so much freedom anymore as it is this proxy fight for social justice, meaning people want government to help people who need help most. They have the right to vote for that. And we haven't figured a way to properly structure that yet. That's what Cap and Prioritize is. So once that comes online, then we're trending towards freedom in even yet another vector. And so freedom wins. That's the good news.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
I still don't entirely understand though why this delay when everyone, like as of last night, the one chapel that I do a lot of videography for was sending out emails. Okay, everyone, be prepared tomorrow at 2 p.m. We've got a lot of photographers on call. We've got ministers on call just in case there's this, you know, influx, which was expected, and now all of a sudden not. But why? Like, it just, I'm still not clear on why they're saying, well, hold on a second.
That is actually a very important feature of government, and James Madison talks about this in one of the Federalist Papers. I think it's number 10, I'm not sure. It's important that the gears of government turn slowly so that the voters have time to say, oh, wait, we made a mistake back there. We want to change that before it's too late. So the fact that government moves slowly, courts move slowly, and so on, and that there's a big argument, a big fight, big due process battle, that's entirely appropriate, and it's a good thing. It's frustrating at times, especially when there's a sense of inevitability, it's going this direction, why can't you just stop? Well, we can't stop because we have to keep fighting for what we believe in, all of us. That's how we end up eventually making the right decisions.
Oh, okay. Good. All right, so let's take another quick break, guys. We're going to come back in a few minutes with Jay Amernick's Inside Perspective, and we'll be right back with you on The Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. Before the break, we were talking about the top story, which was the legalization of gay marriage in Idaho and Nevada, but it's temporarily been put on hold. They've asked for a stay, so that's a developing story that we'll keep an eye on. In the meantime, we're going to have Inside Perspective with Jay Amernick. Now, Jay used to work in government as he can tell us.
I didn't work in government. I worked for an NGO involved with government. So I was
okay. So he's had an insider view on how government works, how politics work. So we call this Inside Perspective because he has a unique perspective that none of the rest of us on this show have. So go ahead, Jay. Tell us today's Inside Perspective.
Okay. Today is this. Voting against something isn't necessarily voting against something. And what I mean by that is when people like to make political hay out of, all these Republicans voted against equal pay for women. Well, they're not necessarily voting against that. When it comes to legislation, the devil is in the details. And quite frankly, they will look at the legislation and say, sometimes it's feel-good legislation. You know, the Equal Pay Act, like, well, if you vote against that, you're clearly against equal pay. They may or may not be, but it's usually something in the legislation that they don't like, that they don't want implemented. A great example of that actually was back in my lobbying days, there was a piece of pro-Israel legislation, and Barney Frank, who was a very good friend of the U.S.-Israel relationship, voted against it. He's a Democrat, so on the right, they were making political hay. Barney Frank, breaks ranks, no longer pro-Israel. And it was ridiculous. Barney Frank came out and he said, look, the reason I voted against this is because this bill, he said, you guys put a bunch of schmutz on it. His exact words, schmutz mean is Yiddish for dirt. So they did. They put a bunch of crapola in it that made it a less appealing piece of legislation and didn't really do what it initially set out to do. So like I said, you have to look at that as opposed to, whatever that, those on the right, come out and say, oh, so-and-so is, is against the, veterans or whatever, it's usually the details of that piece of legislation, no matter what kind of pretty title it may have, doesn't really do what it says it's going to do, or it doesn't do it to the satisfaction of whomever is voting against it.
Okay. Rick, what do you think? You want to disagree?
I completely agree with Jay.
What?
I think, he picked such a safe topic this time that he's absolutely right. Okay? It reminds me of the Casablanca, I'm shocked to find gambling going on in this casino, and, you're winning, sir,
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm shocked to know the politics that is going on in politics. I agree with you that nothing is as it appears in politics. And if so, it's the exception. The vast majority of times, there's something else going on that's motivating a behavior. And Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, for example, because of his base, has not only the permission but the incentive to say all these things that he could never say if he was a senator from pretty much any other state. Whereas Bernie Sanders, on the other hand, from Vermont, okay, self-proclaimed socialist, and Vermont loves that. And so there's always something deeper going on, and that's actually why we ended up in this effort to discover the root to problem. We ended up discovering this cap and prioritize thing, because if you don't fix the structural incentives, then you're not going to fix the root problem, okay? Because that is the root problem. So you got to fix the structural incentives. You have to cap spending and prioritize spending so that that, you know, we have our budget, and then we fight for priorities. And then within those priorities, the best stuff will win, results will matter for the first time ever, and then we have a shot at knowing what people really believe in terms of priorities, because the priorities will be more transparent. Right now, it's all a game.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. That's how I was going to tie it into Cap and Prioritize, is that actually it will force legislation, the legislation itself, to be more thoughtful, effective, and precise.
Yeah.
And probably a lot shorter, too, which will be nice.
And, you know, something we haven't talked a lot about is the fact that Cap and Prioritize is a spending reform, but a lot of what the political right especially complains about is regulations. So let's talk for just a minute about how this might affect regulations. A lot of the regulations that the political right complains about are mandates. Like, hey, if you're going to be in the insurance industry, you have to provide these services. Or if you're going to hire someone, you have to pay this wage, at least, minimum wage. And the problem with all these mandates, first let me say that mandates absolutely kind of jump up, you know, they raise the quality of service in the short term. You know, if you want to give people raises, a minimum wage will give some people raises, okay, a lot of people raises. But in the long term, it ends up having the opposite effect, where I saw a cartoon where the first three rungs of the ladder were cut off, okay, representing the minimum wage, because you got to be up there before you climb up the ladder, and says, hey, teens, I've helped you out. You know, there's Obama saying that. And Obama's holding the saw, because he cut off the first couple of rungs of the ladder. That's the problem with almost all of these mandated regulations. Now, right now, the way government works right now, that these mandates, even with that negative effect, might be the best way to help people. Maybe it is. But once Cap and Prioritize kicks in, once we have competitive government spending, we can find better and better ways to help people, ways that are better than just giving them money and mandating services, then we can start to relax those mandates. And knowing that the government safety net is there to help people who need help most in ways that help them the best, and in parallel, we can let the free market do its thing and have a nice, you know, zero-entry pool, to use a Las Vegas reference. We can have all the rungs on the ladder for people to climb up on without all of these mandated services. The combination of competitive government spending and competitive private investment is the complete solution.
Yeah, well, okay, mandates.
But Rick, you were just talking a little while ago about single moms being in poverty because of the fact that they can't make enough to cover childcare, and that's legitimate. I mean, I've been through that myself. Most of what I've done for the past several years, I can do from home, working for various clients online. But most of my clients are transient, like it's either a project and the project ends, or they use my services for a while and then they change their focus, whatever it happens to be. So twice now, since I've been in Las Vegas, I've not had enough clients to just work at home, so I start doing outside work, like the wedding videography, covering trade shows, stuff like that. And when that happens, obviously I have to get childcare. And there's been a couple of times when it's like, okay, what you're paying me is not worth it. Now, I don't work for minimum wage even. Like, I mean, I haven't worked for minimum wage since I was probably 16. So even with, you know, payments that are higher than that, there's still been, and even when it's as a contractor and not as an employee, there's still been instances where it's like, geez, this just doesn't make sense. I'm either going to be working for $10 when all is said and done by the end of the day, or half of my money is going to childcare. It's just crazy.
Right. So
how can you now say that, you know, if that's the concern, and if most of these single moms are working for, you know, as employees, working for low wages, how can you say, no, it shouldn't be a certain minimum?
Heather, you've actually fallen right into the trap that the proponents of any given mandate will want you to do. One, mandates tend to only look at one side of the issue, and they tend to be come from an emotional place, not a logical place.
I look at this from both sides of the coin. I look at it from as a business owner and as a service provider.
I get that you set up a challenge, a problem. Okay, the solution isn't government saying, okay, then everybody must do this all of a sudden, because that's, because again, mandates tend to be blanketed. And what usually happens with mandates is that they have to start to roll them back, because you find out that there are exceptions to these concepts.
Minimum wage is not that high. It's like $7 or $8 an hour. It's not anything that's going to break a business owner who wants.
That's actually not true. A lot of businesses have said this is not. If it goes up, I'm in a lot of trouble. Because they actually do the math on their individual business. Then they can't afford
to outsource that service, and they need to do that service themselves until they get to the point where they're able to be like Rick and outsource everything. Right, Rick?
Yeah, that's right. let's say the minimum wage, because it's such a clear issue that people can understand. If you cut off the lower rungs of the ladder, the people who aren't worth minimum wage can't get jobs.
Right.
Okay. Now, anyone who's worth minimum wage will get a job and earn more than minimum wage. But the people who are not worth minimum wage don't have jobs. They're forced to be entirely dependent on the government and yet also not have the benefit of learning on the job, where a lot of learning takes place. Okay. So what I'm proposing with Cap and Prioritize is that eventually, like, let's say it's in place for a generation. Okay. Then a generation from now, we will have efficient, effective social services where the education and the housing allowance and the insurance allowances and the food allowances and all those kind of things are in place to help a person supplement their income at whatever level of income they're at. And if they're truly unable to earn more than what would normally be minimum wage, those are the people who will be prioritized, and they'll get more help. So the help will be there. And I think especially in the area of child care, because it's such
like
a core need.
They do have child care subsidies.
So I want you to imagine this. What's that?
They do have child care subsidies available now for people that apply for it and qualify for it. I don't know how widespread it is. I don't know how many subsidies are available, but that is an option for some people.
Yeah, and that's actually a reason why income alone should not be the sole judge of equality. Okay, especially in this day and age when there are so many government services available to help people who need help most. But I'm going to throw one more monkey wrench into the gears here, and that is if you give a person a promise of aid forever, okay, think of what incentives that creates. That creates incentive where I could choose to live such a low lifestyle that I don't need to work at all. I'm almost on retirement. And I can relax, or I can just do a little bit of work on the side for cash, and then I can get by. And so we're killing that person's productive incentives and actually harming them and creating massively negative incentives for them to improve themselves and work really hard. You know, I mean that's just completely destroyed. And that's what we have right now.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
And so not only do we have to not have a minimum wage in the future, again, this is the future where we have cap and prioritized social services where through competition they're better and better and better. But we also have to have a system, and cap and prioritize will do this, where it knows eventually when to cut a person off. Because cutting a person off is part of helping them. Anyone who's tried to help someone who's addicted to drugs or alcohol is probably familiar with this, and they call it, what do they call it? Touch of the E. What's that word?
What? Enabling.
An enabler. Yeah.
You're an enabling. Yeah, duh, okay. I must have early Alzheimer's here coming on. You're enabling the person, okay? So entitlement enables a person in a very unhealthy way. And so under cap and prioritize, there is no entitlement anymore. And that might seem very scary to some people. But what it means is we have all that money that used to be promised to everybody now going only to the people who need help most. It's more focused. It's actually more powerful for the people who need help most. And since ideas have to compete as well, the ideas that help them the most for a time win, and then the person knows that, boy, they do have to step up because this isn't going to last forever, and then they do. And the people who truly can't step up, you know, those are people that we are going to help forever, but that's because of a true lack of capacity, as opposed to someone who's learned enfeeblement or learned dependence or has just chosen that because they can get away with it.
Okay. Cool. So we're going to take another really quick break, and we'll be right back with Outside Perspective, which is Rick's rant. We'll be right back on The Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Bell here with Jay Armanek and Rick Raddatz. Jay's our insider. Rick's our outsider. There you have it. So now we're going to have, now we're going to listen to Rick rant even more than he has been throughout the whole show. This is a segment called Rick Rant. So go ahead and rant, Rick. Rick, go rant. Rant.
Okay.
Let's hear the rant.
My rant today is for all the political activists out there, okay, activists on the left and the activists on the right. Because if you're going to be an activist, let's think about it. You're an activist because you believe in something, right? You're going to fight for that thing you believe in. And that right there is a trap, okay? It's a trap because it gives you this, especially when you all get together on the same side. You start to love being with each other because finally I can talk freely. I can say what I believe. And so it's unavoidable that this happens. But you got to protect yourself against going too far. Because when you're in that echo chamber and you start to really, you feel free and you can express yourself because no one's there to help you say the wrong words, that's when you get too far and you get wrong. Okay? You're just wrong. And so on the political right side, you are wrong when you claim the government has no business being in the helping people business. Some of you believe that. It's unavoidable. People have the right to vote. They're going to vote to help themselves and people they care about. The government is going to be in the helping people whether you like it or not. Okay? The helping people business, whether you like it or not. And on the political left, you want to help people. That's why you're a lefty. That's great. That's unavoidable. That's awesome. But you can't pursue those kinds of goals without a cap. You can't just blame the rich for everything. You can't do that. It doesn't make any sense. You want capitalism to be strong so that we have all this opportunity. And if you want to distribute it well, you have to take a capped budget and you got to prioritize it. Otherwise, results don't matter and you'll never spend better. And you know what? Spending more of money that is just wasted won't ever get you where you want to go. You got to start spending better. And so my rant today is about the echo chamber on the left and right that leads to absolutely wrong conclusions.
I agree 100% with Rick. I'll put a slightly finer point on. Yeah, I will put a slightly finer point on it as well. Is that I think a lot of activists tend to not be focused on efficacy. They tend to be focused on making a lot of noise, which doesn't help their cause at all. So there's they have a lot of sort of ideology, but they don't have any strategy or tactic in order to actually make it come to fruition. They just like making a lot of noise. In most cases, but that's another big problem is that and that goes to what Rick said about when they all get together and they're in that. They get caught up in the zeitgeist of being with each other and all of a sudden that becomes the reality. And they're not really getting anything done. They're not really moving the ball down the court to further their cause.
Okay, so guys, it's tradition on this show that you're supposed to disagree. And so far we've had nothing but agreement between you for the whole show. That's really boring. People don't.
Isn't it beautiful?
Well, not that anyone...
It's beautiful.
No, it's not. Now you're putting me in the position that I have to disagree with both of you.
But if it's...
What's going on here?
No, we shouldn't
disagree. Do you agree with Heather or not?
We shouldn't disagree for disagreement's sake.
Yeah, but correct. You well, are choosing, I guess, either you're more and more agreeing in general, or you're just choosing topics that are so broad and safe that there's nothing to disagree with?
This is actually the power of cap and prioritize, is it turns insiders into smart people.
Yes. Yes.
degrees. I was trying to be antagonistic there.
Actually, what I was going to say was that actually the inside and the outside are actually coming closer together. I think there's some learning on both sides there, and that's and that's actually sort of the aim of CAP Prioritize. Ultimately, is to sort of get everybody together and see what is the most effective way for government to help.
You know, I'll speak on that getting together part. A lot of people believe the left and right can never get together because they can't ever agree on priorities. But the truth is, we can't agree on priorities because we aren't prioritizing. If we separated the budget like it already is into 13 different piles, and then a 14th pile for social spending, and if the social spending was divided among the states, we still disagree on all the details, but we'd have the proper structure to start building a consensus. And so we wouldn't be fighting about helping grandma versus buying submarines. Defense would have their budget and their taxes, and social spending would have their budget and their taxes. And we would be fighting about priorities within each budget. And I think the state of Oregon, where they're prioritizing Medicaid, shows that, at first you do disagree, and they had to prioritize a second time before they got basic agreement. And but then over time, there gets to be more and more consensus about the priorities, and people stop fighting. They fight about something else. So,
Why would they not be fighting, saying, you haven't allocated enough funds in this particular area?
Oh, so you want to bring taxes into this question too? The part of Cap and Prioritize is that we eventually move to a flat tax, meaning everybody pays the same percentage of their income to taxes, and hopefully it's a low percentage, like under 10%. But then if we think government's doing a good job, we all vote on it, and we vote to all pay a little bit more money, rich and poor. And by that, by doing that, we're all saying we like what government's doing, we're all going to give a little bit more. Then that is an approved way, an ethical way, of giving government more money and raising the cap. So Cap and Prioritize allows for a population to vote for all the money to go to government. Communism, that won't ever happen, okay, except in very, very small groups. But theoretically, Cap and Prioritize does not say what size the government should be. It just says that the people have to vote for a cap, basically a tax rate, and then that's the money you spend. That's what Cap and Prioritize is saying.
Okay. Jay, final thoughts?
I would hope that if the flat tax is implemented, that it is below 5%. But that gives everybody some skin in the game.
Okay. We're all gonna hope that. But is it realistic?
Okay. Potentially, sure.
It is inevitable. Inevitable, because if you look at the trend line of human history, over time, over the long term, life is getting better and better and better. Okay, what other decade would you rather live in? Okay, so it's getting better and better and better. And what does that mean? That means it's going to keep on getting better and better, unless we blow ourselves up. Okay, but the point is, we will eventually solve these problems, and then we'll go on to the next problems, and we'll argue about smaller and smaller things, but that's a sign we're getting better and better as a species. So yeah. We will eventually figure this out. Taxes will eventually be very, very small. We'll solve energy problems with technology. We'll solve recycling problems with technology, and we will end up living in a sustainable, beautiful, wonderful, peaceful world in the future, sometime in the future.
Okay. Jay, did you have something else to add to that? You were in the middle of a thought,
getting back to Rick's point about everything getting better and better and better, there will be less need for government to help people. People will be able to help themselves. We're literally working towards teaching the man to fish and not giving him a fish.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Which is ideal.
Well, we've come to the end of another show. It's another great show, guys. We've come to the end of another show. Join us back next week, next Wednesday, same bat time, same bat channel. In the meantime, check us out on politicalfixradio.com. Politicalfixradio.com. You can watch Rick talking on his TED Talk, as well as see some of the archives from our past shows, listen to some of the radio archives, and there's various links to different pertinent sites. So we'll catch you next week. Have a wonderful week. On behalf of myself, Jay Emmernick, and Rick Raddatz, Talk to you next week on The Political Fix.
Thank you for listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. On behalf of Rick Raddatz, Jay Amernick, and myself, Heather Vale Goss, we're glad you chose to get your fix with us. We need reform to fix this country, and incentive reform is what will make a difference. The five economies and resources laid out in Pentonomics and the strategies we call cap and prioritize are the focus of Rick's vision of the optimal political future. Every week we talk about the answers we've dug up among ourselves and with political experts who have the ability to make change happen. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com.